Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Antonio Guterres has made an impassioned plea for peace in Ukraine before UN member states as the devastating conflict approaches its first full year. In a speech to the UN General Assembly meeting in special session in New York on Wednesday, the UN chief lent his support to repeated calls by the international community to end the war since Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022.
War is not the solution. War is the problem. People in Ukraine are suffering enormously. Ukrainians, Russians, and people far beyond need peace. And while prospects may look bleak today, we must all work knowing that genuine, lasting peace must be based on the UN Charter and international law. The longer the fighting continues, the more difficult this work will be.
President of the UN General Assembly, Chaba Kurushi, also insisted that military solutions will not end this war. Too many lives, livelihoods, families and communities have been lost, Mr. Kurushi continued, as he urged Russia to end this hell of bloodshed. The General Assembly is meeting to discuss a draft resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire, for Russia to leave Ukraine, and for accountability for serious crimes and justice for all victims. Armed clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, which left 11 Palestinians dead on Wednesday, have been condemned by the top UN official in the Middle East. Tor Wensland, UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, said that he was deeply disturbed by the loss of life and the continuing cycle of violence. Witnesses reported explosions and gunfire in Nablus as Israeli forces attempted to round up wanted Palestinian militants. A teenage boy and a 61-year-old man were among the victims killed at the scene. In a statement, Mr. Wensland said that he would continue to engage with all parties to de-escalate the situation. He also urged all sides to refrain from inflaming an already volatile situation. Health news now, and a warning from UN agencies that a woman dies during pregnancy or childbirth every 2 minutes. That worrying finding is linked to new data showing major setbacks for maternal health in many parts of the world, even though many of the problems are preventable. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, maternal deaths have either increased or stagnated nearly everywhere, from 223 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births in 2020, down from 227 in 2015 and 339 in 2000. Unless progress is made on global targets for reducing maternal deaths, the lives of over 1 million more women by 2030 could be at risk, the UN Health Agency warned. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, my co-host Julie Horwitz and I, Marjorie Cohn, speak with attorney Jonathan Moore, who represented Eric Garner's family and the Central Park Five.
Jonathan discusses the systemic nature of police violence and abuse in New York and around the country and gives us ideas for what changes are needed.
We'll also speak with journalist Michael Hayes about secrecy and the New York City Police Department.
Michael is author of The Secret Files, Bill de Blasio, the NYPD, and the Broken Promises of Police Reform. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Horwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Horwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
On January 7th, after an unlawful traffic stop, several police officers in the Scorpion unit of the Memphis Police Department beat, kicked, punched, and tased Tyree Nichols, who posed no threat to the public or the officers. He died in the hospital 3 days later. Scorpion, which was disbanded following Nichols' death, stands for Street Crimes Operation to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods. In reality, Scorpion's targets, as with similar such units around the country, were primarily black men. Far from restoring peace, these officers escalated the violence and killed Nichols. The officers later lied about stopping him for reckless driving, and the police chief admitted there was no legal basis for stopping Nichols. 1 month later, in his State of the Union address, President Joe Biden introduced Nichols's parents, who were in the audience, and he called for police reforms. We all know that racist police violence is nothing new. It has shown itself over and over throughout our history and has led to calls for reform of the police and abolition. But structural and systemic racism and police violence persist nevertheless. In spite of the worldwide outrage at the public execution of George Floyd in 2020 and several superficial reforms, police killings continue to increase, not decrease. We are fortunate today to speak with Jonathan Moore. He is a civil rights attorney in New York City who, since the late 1970s, has specialized in police and governmental misconduct, employment discrimination, First Amendment advocacy, and international human rights law. Jonathan represents the family of Eric Garner, who was killed in broad daylight in 2014 by the New York City police for allegedly selling loose cigarettes. He was also the lead attorney in the New York stop and frisk case in 2013 that led to the historic ruling banning the practice as unconstitutional. And he represented the exonerated five, formerly known as the Central Park Five, in their successful wrongful conviction against the city of New York. Jonathan Moore, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Marjorie and Julie.
Broken windows policing, or order maintenance policing, inspired the creation of the Scorpion Unit in Memphis, Tennessee. Please tell our listeners what broken windows policing is and whether it's proven to be an effective method of policing. What racialized assumptions underlie it, and are they valid?
Well, those are a lot of questions to ask, to answer at one time, but I'll see what I can do. The broken windows policing originated with a guy named Jack Maple, who was in the New York City Police Department way back in the 1970s. His theory was that by targeting low-level crimes, quality of life crimes, the famous example here in New York was the squeegee cars at intersections. By targeting them, you would send a message to anybody wanting to commit crime that every level of crime will be policed and that you will be arrested. And you also saw it with notion of fare beating, of people jumping on the subway without paying. So that was the theory, and the theory was to send a message to the community that they shouldn't do anything because the police were going to be there on the low-level crimes. And the sort of secondary benefit was that by stopping people, you could run their names, see if they had warrants, and who knows what you could catch. And that was the origin of it. The concern has always been that it was targeted only at certain communities, obviously mostly communities of color, at least the experience in New York. As a technique of law enforcement, it really has never been shown to be successful. Stop and frisk circumstance is a good example of it, which was sort of a kind of quality of life, broken windows kind of policing, where basically you stopped everybody on the street and to see if they had any kind of weapons. On the flimsiest and sometimes absolutely fraudulent justification. In fact, when we finally looked at 4 million of such stops, it turned out that 90% led to no law enforcement activity at all. And actually, when they stopped doing all the stop and frisk stops at the level they were doing, crime actually went down, not up. The whole notion of the broken windows policing is a real controversial one, and it's never been shown to work. It is, however, not exactly what was going on in Memphis. Memphis was a different kind of policing. It was a sort of aggressive, militarized notion of having these units that would be designated to go into certain areas where identified as, quote, high crime areas, and simply stop and toss in the parlance of the police department everybody they came in contact with for the thinnest of excuses, like a broken taillight or something like that. These are units that were very aggressive. They led to a lot of harm. In New York, it was the Diallo case back in February of 1999, which, by the way, was done by a unit called the Street Crime Unit. The Scorpion, the first two letters of the Scorpion Unit in Memphis was street crime. So this whole idea that you can deal with street crime by having these units that go out and target people for stops and questions and all kinds of stuff was shown in New York to be unconstitutional, and it was motivated by race. So, and I think that would probably be true in every other major city in the U.S.
John, I'd like to segue from what you've just been explaining into the issues of the use of body-worn cameras and the banning of chokeholds, which are two topics and examples of police reforms that are frequently cited as necessities in order to hold officers and police departments more accountable. We saw, however, that using body-worn cameras did not stop the officers in Memphis from killing Tyree Nichols. And you know from your representation of Eric Garner that banning chokeholds in New York City did not stop the officer there from choking Mr. Garner to death. Explain to our listeners why the significance of these methods and requirements regarding body-worn cameras and chokeholds, and why they are not necessarily effective in preventing racist police violence.
That's a good question. If you look at most police manuals of most major police departments, their guidelines, they all sound very good about how they're going to respect the Constitution and not break the law and punish cops for doing wrong. But in fact, they don't do it. And that's a problem with looking at body-worn cameras as a panacea or simply banning a technique. Unless you have follow-up, unless you have accountability when there are violations, they're meaningless as a reform. We've seen that in over 8 years of the remedial phase of the stop and frisk case. The case was resolved in 2013. We started the remedial phase in earnest in 2014, and actually one of the use of body-worn cameras really came out of the remedial effort in Floyd and the stop and frisk case. What we've seen over the period of time when they've been using it is that they don't follow their regulations with respect to when to turn it on, when to turn it off, or maintaining it, or even using it. The officers, most of the officers in the Tyree Nichols case, didn't even turn on the body-worn camera. So right there you have a violation. I mean, there obviously it's a minor violation, but that happens all the time. The point is, unless you have accountability followed by discipline when officers violate the law, not the law, but violate their administrative regulations, the departmental regulations, unless you have accountability, they're not going to change. They act with impunity. You know, you could come up with all the great reforms you want, unless and until police departments start actually holding people responsible. I'm not just talking about officers. I'm talking about supervisors, precinct commanders, borough commanders, even up to the level of the chief of department. Unless you start holding people accountable for how officers act, all these reforms are going to be meaningless.
Jonathan, in May of 2022, Joe Biden issued an executive order that includes many features of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which is a bill that died in Congress. Biden's executive order applies to federal cases, and the reforms it includes are clearer use of force standards, anti-bias training, stepped-up data collection on the use of force, and the establishment of a database recording instances of misconduct by federal law enforcement. It also bans no-knock raids and chokeholds. Do you think these reforms are sufficient to stop racist police violence, and why or why not?
Well, I don't think they are, because I think they miss the mark. There's no question that police departments should have clear use of force standards. They should have databases. They should have anti-bias training, unconscious bias training, all those things. But unless you have some kind of system of accountability, which includes holding the leadership responsible for what happens and disciplining officers in a meaningful way when they violate their oath of office, unless you have that, these reforms are simply paper reforms. They don't have an effect on the street in terms of how officers do their job. And you saw that in Memphis, and you saw it in the Garner case, and you see it in a lot of these cases where these officers know that they're being videotaped, but they do what they do anyway. Why would a rational person continue to violate somebody's right? Why would Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis keep his knee on George Floyd's neck when he knows that people are videotaping that? Because they don't expect that they'll be punished for it.
So given these realities, there is now a growing movement that calls for the abolition of police or the defunding of police. And we all recognize that that is not a goal that is able to be accomplished in the near future. What do you see in terms of accountability? What do you see as changes that should be made in the meantime regarding those victims of police violence who really are only in serious need of help? Mental health crises, drug incidents, domestic violence crises, and so on.
The notion of defund the police is a complicated one. Let me just say a couple of things about it. If you go to most communities in major American cities, particularly communities of color, they will say, are you crazy? We don't want to defund the police. We want more police because we have crime and we want the police to be there. But we want them to act in a constitutional manner. We don't want them just stopping people, young kids on the street, making them fearful that when they go out of the house, they're going to be stopped. So that, you have to take that into account. Building on that, I think there's a way to reimagine how the police do their job now in a way that will make it would be a progressive development. Take mental health, take folks who are involved in, you know, like overdoses of drugs. The first line of reaction there is to send the police in. And maybe that's inappropriate. And we know that's inappropriate in a lot of cases, particularly in cases where people are in mental health crisis. The police are not trained to do that kind of work. They don't have the skill or ability to deal with somebody who is in a mental health crisis, for example. And so the default is to arrest and take them and dump them into a hospital and have them seen by a psychiatrist, even if they're not exhibiting any conduct that is a danger to themselves or others. Let's not talk about defunding the police because it's such a charged term. Let's talk about reimagining how the police, how cities deal with crisis intervention. I don't even want to call them police. Call them crisis intervention managers, or whatever you want to say. Because in New York, for example, there's at least 250,000 calls every year to the police department for somebody who's having a mental health crisis. Under their guidelines, they're required to take all those people into custody, even if they're not exhibiting any behavior at the moment that exhibits some kind of dangerous conduct. I could call the police on my neighbor and say, my neighbor was coming up in the elevator, and she said, I had a really tough day. Gee, I feel like, jumping out the window. I feel like, you know, jumping into the lake or something. And I could call the police and say, my neighbor just said she's thinking of committing suicide. And the police would come, and they would take her into custody, and they would take her to a hospital, have her, and she'd have to be evaluated by a mental health professional before she could be released. If you had people who were trained to deal with people in mental health crisis, to determine whether there's even a mental health crisis going on, you would avoid that. It's these kind of just rational thinking that we should be applying to how the police do their work.
So instead of police being the first responders to people who are, say, going through a mental health crisis, it should be people trained in mental health. Repeatedly, we see people who are experiencing a mental health crisis, the police arrive, the person is acting in a very kind of crazy way, if I might, and the police overreact, use their tasers, and frequently kill them. Most of the officers involved in the killing of Tyre Nichols were black, as was Nichols himself. Is the race of the perpetrating cops or of the victim determinative? What do you think?
This is one of those moments when you can really educate people about the nature of the police in modern-day America. I mean, there's clearly the overlay of race that is present in a lot of situations. Have been in the past. We have mostly a white police force patrolling in a mostly black or Latino neighborhood, young kids from the suburbs who are, no experience of dealing with people in the inner city come in, and it's a recipe for disaster. But over the years, that the proportion of black officers in most major metropolitan police departments have changed, and I think today, for example, in New York City, the majority of the patrol officers are non-white. That doesn't mean that race doesn't play a factor. You have to look at several things. You have to look at where they're sent to do their work, and on what basis they're deployed to certain neighborhoods. These kind of tactical units, are they always sent to neighborhoods of color rather than to other neighborhoods? And so it's superficial to just say having black police officers is going to solve the problem. The problem is that the culture of policing in the United States has become so off the mark in terms of performing in a constitutional fashion, places pressure on every police officer to act in an aggressive manner, in a militaristic manner. The Nichols case, the Garner case, the Amadou Diallo case, the Abner Louima case, the McDonald case in Chicago, other cases around the country, when they get a lot of attention, yes, those officers may get disciplined, or they may not even get disciplined. Let me tell you a short vignette from the trial in the stop and frisk case. This is our witness in the case. In our case, was Eric Adams, who's now the mayor of New York City. He had been a police captain a member of the New York City Police Department. At the time he testified in our case, he was a state senator. He came in and testified. He was at a meeting with Ray Kelly, who was then the police commissioner of New York Police Department, and with the then governor of New York, David Paterson. And Senator Adams, at the time Senator Adams and Governor Paterson, was saying to Raymond Kelly, why are you doing this? Why are you like going overboard with stop and frisk? The community hates it. You're making it so difficult for the community to trust the police. It's having a negative effect. Why are you doing it? Eric Adams testified in trial that Ray Kelly said to him, we do stop and frisk to instill fear in the minds of every young black and brown kid who goes out in the street, that every time they go out, they'll be stopped. That, to me, was a chilling bit of testimony. It was cited by the court in finding that the police department had maintained for several years a policy of racial profiling. And she invited Ray Kelly to come in and testify that that wasn't true, and they wouldn't bring him in. So, that was a very powerful piece of evidence, and it's exactly what they they have done, what police departments around the country have done, is they've told their officers to act in this way, and they've said to them, we have your back. And for 99% of the time, they have their back.
That is quite chilling. And there are examples like that I know from departments all over the country where the same stories could be told. I've got testimony from a black police officer here in Detroit who testified under oath. The culture is so deep. The culture of policing is so deep that every time he goes out on the street, even as a black man, every black person he encounters is a criminal in his mind.
I'm Marjorie Cohn, and my co-host Julie Hurwitz are talking with Jonathan Moore, lawyer for Eric Garner's family and the Central Park Five.
When a person in the community is killed or beaten by the police, the response is often, most police are good, but there are just a few bad apples. President Biden made this claim in a State of the Union address. Can you comment on this claim?
Yeah, well, you know, that when you hear that, that always bothers me when I hear that, because it obfuscates the true nature of what the police are doing. Yes, there are really bad police officers. There's no doubt about it. But the problem is not the bad apples. The problem is that the barrel that those apples are in are bad. It's a bad barrel. It's a police department that reinforces and protects officers who engage in aggressive behavior. Yes, on occasion, it may become so extreme that they have to respond, like in the Garner case. You know, eventually, Officer Pantaleo was fired by the police. It took, of course, 5 years, and for those 5 years, he got his full salary, but he was eventually fired. Interestingly enough, the other four officers who were involved in taking Eric Garner down, who were responsible as equally as Pantaleo for his death, because the medical examiner ruled that his death was a result of a combination of a chokehold and chest compression. So those other officers who were on top of Garner, while Pantaleo had his arm around his neck, were just as responsible for his death as Pantaleo, but they were not even disciplinary charges not brought against even brought against them, let alone litigated. So it's not that there are bad apples. That's not the answer. That doesn't get you anywhere. It's that the institution of policing has become so disconnected from the communities who are most affected by how they do this policing. There's no community engagement. There's no attitude on the part of police departments to listen to the community about what their needs are. You know, and there's no accountability up the chain of command when things go awry. I mean, a federal court in 2013 found that the New York City Police Department had been engaged in a pattern and practice of racial profiling for a number of years, also violating the Fourth Amendment rights of people, Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment. Nobody was called to account for that. That could only have occurred had the leadership of the New York City Police Department said, we want to keep doing this. We know it's bad. We want to keep doing it. In fact, in the remedial efforts of the police department in the Floyd case, the stop and frisk case, the first Floyd case, part of the training included a video presentation by the then commissioner of the New York City Police Department, a remarkable piece of evidence. He said, James O'Neill, who at the time was the police commissioner, he said, we're giving you this training because we've had a lot of problems with stop and frisk. It's eliminated the trust that we expect to get from the community. A lot of people are upset about it. And we want you to know that it's not your fault. It's our fault. We asked you to do these things, and now we're asking you to do it differently. And that was a powerful message. I've never seen that in any circumstance before. It's the lack of accountability. And then even if you sue the police officers, then you're hit with all these other judge-created doctrines like qualified immunity and privileges that protect them from having to disclose certain information about how they've operated within the police department, their history in the police department. And it denies people the fundamental right to hold police officers accountable. And when I talk about the importance of holding the institution accountable, the problem is it's so difficult to accumulate all the evidence that you need to satisfy in court the standard of being able to show that as a matter of policy and practice, a police department had a policy of violating constitutional rights. Those are very difficult cases. So that makes it extremely difficult to hold the agency accountable. And then if you have a doctrine like qualified immunity, which basically says it's a defense that the officers can use to say, I didn't know that my conduct violated the law, and therefore I shouldn't be liable. So you put those together, you basically have very little remedies available to people whose rights are violated by the police.
Yeah, the police say, I didn't know that choking somebody to death violated the law. Well, we're at the end of our allotted time, Jonathan. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I work, I'm a partner in the law firm of Belloc, Levine & Hoffman. You can follow the work of our firm and my work on www.blhny.com. But a lot of what I do and a lot of what folks like Julie Hurwitz and other lawyers around the country do on police accountability can be accessed through being in touch with the organization called the National Police Accountability Project.
Well,
thank you
so much, Jonathan Moore. We really appreciate giving us your thoughts on this really critical and outrageous practice that we're seeing all over the country.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. We really appreciate you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and gone? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says, kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will run, don't sleep. Life can be so unkind. I will be found on the edge of the world, where there'll be no one around. Falling down.
The issue of police reform looms large across the nation, with daily reports and images of lethal police violence against black and brown persons striking a collective raw nerve. A new book by journalist Michael Hayes reads like both an investigative report and a gripping saga of the nation's largest police department. Its protagonists are the New York City Police Department, its powerful union, black and Latino New Yorkers, and Mayor Bill de Blasio. The book is called The Secret Files, Bill de Blasio, the NYPD, and the Broken Promises of Police Reform. Bill de Blasio, mayor from 2014 to 2021, focused his campaign on making the NYPD more accountable to the public. Previously, while serving on the New York City Council, he introduced legislation to expand the purview and clout of the watchdog agency, the Civilian Complaint Review Board. while in office, de Blasio tried to end the NYPD's longstanding stop-and-frisk policy, among other pernicious practices. But from the beginning of his tenure, after two officers were fatally shot in Brooklyn in December 2014, the police department and its union doubled down in opposition to reform. One example was to effectively prevent public disclosure of internal investigation files or the identities of police officers known to be the subjects of those investigations. Joining us today is Michael Hayes. In addition to his recently released book, Michael has long reported on the policies and practices of U.S. police departments and covered major criminal trials across the nation. Michael, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, let's begin with the title of your book, The Secret Files. What are the secret files, and what is their relevance to your topic?
Sure. So thanks again for having me on. The secret files refer to the NYPD's disciplinary files, which were kept secret for about 40 years thanks to a state law that said that all law enforcement personnel records, including law enforcement officers' disciplinary history, should be kept secret. My involvement, or first involvement, with these secret files came in 2018 when I was working as a reporter at BuzzFeed. A source passed me and another reporter a cache of about 2,000 of these files on 1,800 NYPD officers that covered about 5 years. And we spent a year investigating the details of those files. One notable finding was that about 300 of the officers featured in those reports. The department themselves said that the officers should have been fired, but instead of doing so, they were allowed to stay on the force and just do a year of probation.
Mayor Bill de Blasio wasn't the first mayor who sought to reform the New York Police Department. Can you give a nutshell history of previous efforts to make the department more accountable?
Sure. So one previous effort we can talk about is efforts to reform the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the CCRB, the outside group that acts as a watchdog that investigates police misconduct in New York City and hands down recommendations of discipline to the NYPD. It's a great example because going back to the 1960s when Mayor John Lindsay was in office, he was the first one to try to reform this group. It's kind of ironic that it was called the Civilian Complaint Review Board because at the time there were no civilians involved in it. It was just police officers on the board investigating police officers. So Mayor Lindsay was able to get a bill passed in the city that added civilians, people outside the employment of the police officer, police department, to the group. Unfortunately for him, the police unions were able to get a referendum pushed through that got that proposal shot down. Fast forward a couple decades later, when Mayor David Dinkins takes office, he tries again to reform the CCRB and turn it into a group that's run by people outside the police department. And it's notable for Mayor de Blasio, he was working for David Dinkins at the time, and that was successful, put the group on the track record to what it is today, which is completely outside the realm of the police department, so to speak.
Michael, tell us about Officer Daniel Pantaleo and the Civil Rights Law 50A.
Sure. So Officer Daniel Pantaleo is kind of the reason that everybody talks about Civil Rights Law 50A. It was certainly the first time that the law came on my radar as a reporter after former Officer Pantaleo put Eric Garner in a chokehold in 2014 and Eric Garner died. A lot of scrutiny was placed on Officer Pantaleo's past misconduct. records, and what reporters found was because of Civil Rights Law 50A, which kept police disciplinary records a secret, it was very hard to figure out what, if any, history that Officer Pantaleo had prior to placing Eric Garner in a chokehold. A couple reporters from the Daily News were able to track down and get a hold of some records of Officer Pantaleo's disciplinary history. And in their early reports, they talk a lot about Civil Rights Law 50A and why it was so effective at keeping not just his records but all NYPD officers' records a secret. Personally, that's what piqued my interest in this topic, going back now 8 years ago.
Yes, Michael, and of course, Civil Rights Law 50A was ultimately repealed. In your book, you go into depth about the police killings of Eric Garner, Ramarlee Graham, Delron Small, and Mohammed Ba. Why does New York have such a violent history of dealing with black and brown communities?
It's notable that we refer to these examples as police killings and not police murders, as sometimes in conversation colloquially people might refer to them. In every one of those cases you just mentioned, Eric Garner, Ramarlee Graham, Delron Small, and Mohammed Ba, nobody was convicted of any crime, let alone murder. So we, unlike for instance, the case of George Floyd, we don't refer to those as police murders. And I think that really speaks to, it puts a very fine point on what you said about the violent history here and how it's most prevalent in the black and brown community. All of those young men you mentioned were black men.
Michael, we all know that police violence and racial profiling is not unique to New York City. Can you talk a bit, please, about how the findings in your book are relevant to U.S. policing institutions as a whole?
Sure. So in terms of the secrecy aspect of it, and you mentioned before how Civil Rights Law 50A was repealed in 2020 after the death of George Floyd, and it marked an example of years of activism coming to the fore and pushing that to happen. That's not necessarily the case in other states. Every state is different when it comes to how they deal with whether they make records of police violence and disciplinary records. Give you a very, very recent example in Tennessee in the Tyre Nichols case. It's a few weeks after that happened, and we still don't know the disciplinary records, disciplinary histories of those former officers, and it's unclear if we ever will. I know that in order to gain access to those records, one, a reporter would have to live in the state of Tennessee to even request those records. So myself personally, living in New Jersey, I'm not going to be any help in figuring that out. And Tennessee, also has an interesting history. Just doing some research into this recently, I found that they're known to ask reporters or media organizations to put up thousands of dollars just to cover searching fees to gain access to those records, which is a stark difference to what we have in New York today. So I think it's a good example of how the bottom line is this is kind of being treated differently in all places across the country.
Michael, please talk about Pat Lynch and the police union, which is called the Police Benevolent Association of New York. Some have referred to Lynch as New York City's blue bulldog. Police unions throughout the country have played a powerful role in preventing accountability and even a modicum of reform on these issues. Is Pat Lynch an anomaly or an exemplar?
That's an interesting nickname for him. It makes me think about my reporting on Pat Lynch and other in talking with folks about him. One thing that I found interesting, a lot of people refer to him as Patty, which is a genial reference. He's well regarded and well respected amongst many New York City police officers, and one reason is he's, you know, and I think the bulldog term here is appropriate too, is he's willing to do pretty much anything to defend his officers. If we're talking about police union leadership around the country, you know, he is the exemplar of a union leader who's mono focus is defend his officers come hell or high water, no matter what. And like I said, you know, a lot of folks inside the NYPD appreciate this effort by Pat Lynch. As far as outsiders go, I think it's a reasonable question whether sometimes he takes it a little too far.
How did Lynch and his officers react to Mayor de Blasio after the December 2014 fatal shootings of two NYPD officers in Brooklyn?
Yeah, so that's a good segue question from my comments about raising the question of whether Pat Lynch takes it too far. It's interesting when I talk to a lot of people about that horrible tragedy that happened when those two officers were killed. People who I would have conversations with would ask me, didn't the officers turn their backs on Bill de Blasio after that happened? And the answer is they didn't do it one time; they did it three times. And Pat Lynch was, it's never been confirmed, but a lot of people believe him to have been the orchestrator of this. He was certainly involved very directly in the first incident where himself and a group of officers turned their backs on the mayor and his police commissioner the night they showed up at the hospital. That was the first time the mayor was on the scene of the tragedy, as it were. And of course, then it happened two more times after that with thousands of officers involved in the streets outside the two funerals for the officers when Mayor de Blasio was giving speeches during those funerals.
I, Marjorie Cohn, and my co-host Heidi Boghossian are speaking with Michael Hayes, author of The Secret Files, Bill de Blasio, the NYPD, and the Broken Promises of Police Reform. Michael, our other guest today on Law and Disorder is Jonathan Moore, co-counsel in the landmark stop and frisk case of Floyd versus City of New York. What did stop and frisk represent in New York City's trajectory of police violence and indeed in the nation?
That's a really interesting way to put it in terms of what it represented. One thing that stop and frisk definitely represents for me is it's the most recent, if not the biggest example ever of when violent police data really stopped the public in its tracks and said, "Hold on, we have a problem here." What drove the headlines around stop and frisk back when it was in the news a lot was the just shocking numbers associated with it. I believe that in 2011, the NYPD approached 700,000 stops in New York City that year. That number alone was enough for people to stop and say, "Is this really necessary?" But as stop and frisk was further scrutinized, it came to be known that just the incredibly small percentage of those stops were actually yielding relevant police matters. Less than 1% were leading to arrests for crimes, and less than 0.1% were leading to officers recovering firearms, which was the chief reason for the stop and frisk strategy, was to try to get more guns off the street.
Tell us about the research process for this book. Was it difficult to obtain records from the New York City Police Department?
It's always very difficult to obtain records from the New York City Police Department. I write about a couple examples of times I fell short while doing the book, and which was very interesting because I set out to do this book after the repeal of Civil Rights Law 50A, when police disciplinary records, the new law of land was, these can be made public if a person puts in a public records request for them, you should give them to them. On top of that, as I write about in the book, after 50A was repealed, the NYPD published its own database of disciplinary records, and when I looked at that over the course of the couple years I was working on the book, I was able to find out that despite that, they're still keeping quite a bit secret, which is interesting. It's a very incomplete record of files that they've put out, despite Mayor de Blasio at the time, when the law was struck down, saying that what the NYPD was going to do would be a historic moment, and it really had an opportunity to be. I mean, the NYPD is the most influential police department in the country, if not the world. When they do something, most other police departments around the United States, at least, take notice and sometimes follow suit. So for them to fall short on what they're doing in terms of making records public, I would argue it's something that reverberates around the country when it comes to policing and transparency.
Michael, you mentioned several special units, such as the Strategic Response Group and the Anti-Crime Unit under current New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Please talk about how those units impact policing. How does the Strategic Response Group compare with the Scorpion Unit in Memphis that killed Tyree Nichols and other similar special operations units in police departments around the country?
Yeah, so that's an interesting comparison. Just to talk about Strategic Response Group, to begin with, they were a unit that was created by former police commissioner, NYPD Commissioner Bill Bratton, in 2015. Bratton created the unit on the back of a terror attack in Paris, and being one to always look for ways to innovate his police department. After that terror attack happened, he decided the NYPD could use its own unit trained in terror tactics, and that was the birth of the Strategic Response Group. They've faced heavy criticism over the years, primarily because this group of officers, which trains daily in anti-terror tactics, is often used to police things like parades and protests where people are just exercising their First Amendment rights. And what it's led to has been some pretty ugly scenes where these officers that are trained in to deal with highly tense, highly potentially violent situations act violently towards people who are just in the streets, again, exercising their constitutional rights. And I would compare it to the Scorpion unit, a unit that, based on what we know so far, was also trained to use brutal tactics, but was going out every night and conducting car stops. It's it doesn't quite connect with the level of enforcement and the message the departments are sending to officers in these units and what they're sending them out to do.
Michael, on that note, how have police responded to the Black Lives Matter movement and police reform movements?
To put it most, I guess, kindly to the police, I would say it's kind of a mixed bag. Now, you mentioned the Black Lives Matter movement and who have been instrumental in driving the massive protest movement that we've seen over the past couple years, as well as been heavily involved state by state in different laws that have led to police reform. I would say police leadership, when I say this, police leadership at big departments around the country have really approached it with an us versus them mentality, particularly in the media. You take, for example, something I write about in the book quite a bit, are the protests that happened after George Floyd was killed in 2020 in New York City. And you had the NYPD going out and using brutal tactics, as well as just falsely arresting hundreds of protesters, and police leadership coming out and really taking it as far as they possibly could to talk down the protests. One example I talk about in the book is how Commissioner Dermot Shea, commissioner of the NYPD at the time, came out and actually lied about what protesters were doing. He said that protesters were bringing weapons and other contraband, and investigation of that found no evidence. And those comments were actually repeated by the mayor at the time. On the other side of things, and the reason I do say that it's a mixed bag in terms of how police have responded, what I've been focusing on in terms of police disciplinary records and transparency, you have a lot of officers of all shapes and sizes, all stripes, all political leanings, certainly all ranks, who think that transparency is a good thing. From their perspective, it's, you know, they don't want the bad cops out who are committing the misconduct out there with them on the job, which is, you know, something I can understand. I think in every work environment, we don't want inept and bad actors working alongside us. So that sort of thing does get a more positive response from the police. You know, the former example of Black Lives Matter and how that movement has been treated by the police, I don't think they've been treated very fairly at all.
Well, do you think that police reforms can be effective, or is defunding and eventually abolishing the police necessary in light of systemic racist police violence?
Well, that's a very good question. Two-part answer again. I absolutely believe police reforms can be effective, and I believe that because in my book there's a story of hope here when it comes to police accountability and transparency. The law that I write about being repealed, Civil Rights Law 50A, and the law that kept police disciplinary records secret, a lot of people think that's something that happened overnight, that was repealed overnight after George Floyd was killed in 2020. It certainly is. That's far from the case. It was years, if not nearly a decade, of work by a very motivated and organized group of activists, largely led by the mothers and other relatives of young Black and brown men who were killed by the police. They got the work done to get that law changed, which was a huge police reform. I think stands as a really good example of police reform. It's I hope when people read the book they agree with me that, you know, there's a story of hope there in terms of police reform.
Michael, it's really an engaging as well as informative book, so congratulations. And how can our listeners follow your work?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. You can find me in a lot of places. I'm on Twitter, just at Michael Hayes. That's probably the best place to find my work. I'm heavily focused on the police accountability issue. So if that's something you're interested in, definitely follow me there and definitely pick up the book, The Secret Files.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.